Here we are. Okay, so I'd like to talk a little bit today about the benefits, mostly, of combining multiple types of paleoecological proxy analyses in an effort to better understand processes of human and natural landscape modification through history. And I want to illustrate this using an example, or two, actually, example proxy data sets from a sediment core from Nyanza, Kenya. And the main objective of my discussion here is to illustrate how pollen and fungal proxies can be used to more accurately identify ecosystemic change through time than could be done with either pollen or fungal proxies alone. And the important thing to realize, first off, is that pollen and fungal spores are in some ways very much alike in that they can be associated with particular sets of conditions, ecological conditions, environmental conditions, etc. But it's important to realize that there are important differences between these two proxies in terms of their associations, the way that they're transported throughout an environment, and the way that they are physically produced. And this is actually, I believe, advantageous for analysts because it gives us a way to deal with issues of potential equifinality that can sometimes be problematic in analysis of paleoecological records. So we can look at what both the fungal record would say and what the pollen record would say about the ecological and human history of a locality and use both data sets to more accurately ferret out what the potential causes of change in local ecologies are and have been through history. And these are a few examples. It's top is laser, yes. Okay, this is a maize pollen grain right here. It's just an example of something that's, that you might see in a pollen core, and this is going to become important later. Over here on the lower right, this is what is believed to be representative of the Fusarium genus, which has been associated closely with various cultigens, fresh wild and stored cultigens. And over here on the lower left, this is a spore of from the Ascodesmus genus that's associated with animal dung, domestic and wild animal dung. And that's used as a proxy for the presence of that. But what my research is focused on is not so much long-term ecological change, but rather on identifying ways that we can make changes to local ecologies due to intensifying food production, herding, pastoralism, etc., more visible from an analytical standpoint. And in East Africa, this has been particularly problematic with regard to early cultivation and agricultural activities. And also with pastoralism, but to a much lesser extent. And as you can see, we really don't know nearly as much as we'd like about early farming economies in this region, mostly because archaeologists have so far turned up very, very little in the way of actual macrobotanical remains. So following this, various types of secondary material evidence have been used to inform interpretations of early farming economies, things like iron remains, ceramic remains, and other various more easily visible and better preserved proxies such as these. Right. Archaeological research has actually been pretty extensive in the Nyanza region, which is in far, far western Kenya. We'll look more closely at the locality that we covered in a minute. And it's around the shores of Lake Victoria, mostly on the northeastern coast of Lake Victoria. In the 1960s, Gable proposed a chronology for the region that's basically argued that for the most of the last 3,000 years, the economy has been a mixed economy focused on pastoralism, hunting, and fishing from the lakeshore. And that's only in the last few centuries, just the last few pre-colonial centuries, have things like intensified maize agriculture, rice agriculture, and various types of arboriculture become more important. And David Schoenbrunn, based on historical linguistic evidence, also agrees that this is what's going on, but it would really be nice if we had the hard archaeological evidence to back up assumptions that we make based on things like glottal chronology. So the objectives of the project are, first, to identify the pollen and fungal remains that have been present in Nyanza, at least around this locality through history. Two, to identify evidence of ecological change and landscape modification by humans over time, if there is any. Three, to identify paleobotanical proxies for cultivars, as well as evidence for pastoralism in the same vein. And lastly, to interpret the evidence for landscape modification within the local socio-cultural and environmental context. Now, as far as the locality itself, let me give you a little bit better idea about it. Yala Swamp is, as I said before, on the northeastern shores of Lake Victoria, and in places it's actually contiguous with the larger body of Lake Victoria. But the coring location itself, that I promise we will get to, is a little bit further inland, away from the shores, and it's actually very, very close to the margins of a small sub-inlet called Lake Saru, which is actually, again, contiguous with the lake itself. But what's interesting about Lake Saru is that there are several archaeological sites, numerous archaeological sites, actually, that have been excavated by, among others, Paul Lane and colleagues, and that are, again, very close to the lake. And the coring locality was selected with this in mind. So we collected a core, and we ended up with 2 meters, only a 2-meter core of organic-rich sediment that we used that we got using a modified piston core. And so we subsampled this core in the field and returned these subsamples to the Department of Anthropology at WSU, to the Paleo Environments Lab. We chemically isolated and floated pollen and fungi away from the rest of the sediments. We identified different taxons present, and we counted them up to a minimum of 400 grain count for both pollen grains and fungal spores. And lastly, we graphically rendered and interpreted our results. So just to review briefly before looking at the data itself, pollen and fungal spores, for that matter, can be used to examine both climate change and local vegetational mosaics. But I would argue that the most important aspect of local climates with regard to human populations and the economic strategies that they practice is overall moisture availability rather than effective temperature or gross changes mean temperature over time. So fluctuations in moisture availability, giving us relatively humid or arid conditions over time, is something to be cognizant of in analysis dealing with narrower time resolution, like this study does. Okay, so some examples of indicator taxons that can be used to infer climatic change that traditionally have been used to do so are genera including Carex, which is a type of sedge within the family Cyperaceae, but also taxons that are arboreal, like Podocarpus and Syzygium, which are more closely associated with marginal swamp environments. On the flip side of that coin, we would see taxons that would be more closely associated with aridity, things like grass species within Poaceae, and less commonly in this region, things like Acacia within Adansonia. So just again to review, increased concentrations, as represented in a pollen diagram over time, of things like Carex, Podocarpus, and Syzygium would suggest a higher moisture availability. And conversely, expansions in Poaceae and things like Acacia would suggest lower moisture availability. Very ably. Okay, so in addition to having proxies for climate change, we also have proxies that could potentially be interpreted as indicators of human landscape modification. Okay, we have things like Asteraceae and Cunopodiaceae and Amaranthaceae, which are closely associated with landscape disturbance. But we also have taxons that could potentially signal to us that cultivation is going on. Things like the Convolvulaceae family, various genera within Convolvulaceae, which is a sweet potato family, and arboreal taxons like Myristicaceae, which is the family that nutmeg belongs to, and it's been very very important in the Indian Ocean spice trade historically. And this is obviously maize right here, which comes into play a little bit later. So as far as fungal proxies go, these are, in addition to pollen, being used more and more to look at climatic change and habitat modification through history. But these can be also be used to examine these types of conditions alongside pollen assemblages. So these are a few examples, again, of what we said. We've seen Fusarium before, as well as Ascodesmus. But this is a representative of Tetraploa, which is, again, associated with various cultigens. But we also have fungal proxies that have been identified by, among others, Gallerini and colleagues and Van Giel and colleagues, which these are two very closely coordinated studies. We also have fungal proxies for things like human and animal dung, wild and domestic animal dung, and soil erosion. Taxons like Glomus. All right, so as I mentioned earlier, fungi can not only tell us about ecological conditions, but also about nearby substrates that fungi are frequently commensal with. Okay, so, I went too fast. So over here, we have fungi which have been frequently associated with burnt vegetation, right? So pyrophilus, fungi, and fungi that are commensal with decayed vegetation as well, the existence of vegetation that's just sitting around and decaying. But we also see that there can be fungal proxies for growing and stored cultigens, things like various millets, sorghums, maize, etc. All right, so finally, right, we come to our pollen data from this core. And there are a few different things that you'll notice right away. And I have to apologize that direct dating on this core has not been finished yet. So this core has not been directly dated. But I think that's okay because we still have something that lets us serve our purposes. As you can see right here, Zea maize, which is obviously maize, is present in about the top half of the core. And the introduction of maize into broader East Africa has been pretty securely dated at around or just prior to 1700 CE. So this is obviously a very young core in comparison to some of the other paleoecological records that we have from East Africa. But it does, as I said before, still serve our purposes. So what we can see here early on is that we have fluctuations which tend to be kind of inversely related to each other between Cyperaceae or sedges and grasses, taxons within the grass family. And we tend to see this fluctuation only in the early part of the history that's captured by this core. And towards in the more recent history, we see an expansion of Cyperaceae at the expense of grasses, which would suggest in itself that there is greater moisture availability than at any other time in the basically in the history of the core. But what you'll also notice is that the total fern sum crashes precipitously at about that same time. And this also happens to coincide with when we see the beginnings of maize farming. Right? But the thing about most fern species is that they generally need a reliable and good source of water or moisture. And that's kind of contrary. The signal we see here is kind of contrary to what would be suggested by the relationship between grasses and sedges. Right? And we also see further evidence that there's probably greater moisture availability by the fact that we see increased concentrations of Juniperus and Podocarpus at the same time, which also do well in a very moist environment. In addition to that, what we see is a crash, which is never among Convolvulaceae or the sweet potato family, which has never formed a large portion of the pollen mosaic, but we also see declines in Myristicaceae, which is another potential economic, as we said earlier. So it's not exactly clear what it is that's going on right here, and I'll wrap up quickly, excuse me. But when we look at the fungal spectrum from this site, and I apologize, these fungal spores are, this is an error of mine, are organized by fungal spore morphology and not by substrate or ecological affinity. So if you'll excuse me, I'll try to define them. What we see here, right, coincident with both the onset of potentially wetter conditions and maize farming, is an increase in Tetraploa aristata and what we believe to be Fusarium, both of which have been associated with various cultigens, including various cultivated grass species, Zea maize, and even bananas. And at the same time, what we see is a decrease in Glomus, the Glomus genus, which is associated with soil erosion. And this is kind of a counterintuitive signal. But what we also see right here is a decrease in Coniochaeta, in the entire Coniochaeta genus, which is this fungal proxy is associated with animal dung. Now, whereas this seems to crash coincident with Glomus, I would argue that as a portion of the entire fungal spectrum, Coprophilus fungal species tend to diversify but stay the same. As you can see, that things like Sporobiella and Sordaria, which are also associated with animal dung, tend to increase at the same time. And in addition to that, what we see coincident with this transition is an increase in urocystis, which is also associated with various cultigens. Most notably various grass species and Brassicaceae, which is where a lot of the traditional African greens lie in terms of their family association. Okay, so I'll wrap up immediately. So in overview, I think that we can see evidence for a significant human impact on the local environment through history, primarily through cultivation, land clearance, and grazing activities, although we probably see some changes in pastoral activity at this point, coincident with the introduction of more intensive cultivation. We see limited maize agriculture in recent centuries, the cultivation of numerous tree and shrub species, and we see that pastoralism is de-emphasized, likely during the late history, in favor of a more mixed strategy, which still includes pastoralism, but also includes arboricultural and grass cultivation-based economic strategy. I'd like to briefly thank John G. Jones, Karen Lupo, who I'm not sure is around, and Colin Greer, as well as the Palynology and Paleo Environments Lab at Washington State University.